Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Election Day is less than 2 weeks away. Throughout the month of October, Smart Talk has featured conversations with candidates for governor, U.S. Senate, and the U.S. House of Representatives. We invited 23 candidates to participate. So far, 19 have agreed to or have appeared on the program. We're posting all these conversations on WITF.org/elections for comparisons. Today, we hear from Lou Barletta, the Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate. He is running against incumbent Democratic Senator Bob Casey and two others. Currently, Barletta is a congressman from northeastern Pennsylvania, although his district runs southwest into Carlisle. Let's hear what Lou Barletta has to say. Lou Barletta, welcome to Smart Talk.
Yeah, good to be here.
Let's start with the basic question. Why are you running for the U.S. Senate?
Well, you know, I had a House seat that I probably could have kept that House seat for a long time, but I saw the gridlock, especially in the Senate, where one vote could be the difference, whether it was, repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act, or whether it was the next Supreme Court pick. One vote there could be the difference in the direction that the country was going. So I didn't go to Washington for a job. I went there to actually try to get something done. And I felt that I'm willing to give that seat up because that one vote could be Pennsylvania. And it could make the difference for our country.
When there is an incumbent like there is with Bob Casey, your opponent, one of your opponents in the November 6th election, often it's looked upon as a referendum on the incumbent. How do you differ from Bob Casey?
Well, I think the contrast probably couldn't be any greater in this election. You know who Bob Casey is. And what I stand for, and the Bob Casey today that's there, Senator Bob Casey, is not the same senator that got elected by the people of Pennsylvania in 2006. In 2006, Senator Casey was a pro-life, pro-Second Amendment, moderate Democrat, which I thought fits Pennsylvania pretty well. However, as the Democrat Party has continued to shift left, Senator Casey moved with them and has now become one of the more liberal senators in Washington, voting with Bernie Sanders most of the time, 92% of the time, supports sanctuary cities, supports catch and release, open borders policies that we're watching what's happening right now at the border with the caravan, against the tax cuts, which are helping so many people in Pennsylvania. He's against the energy jobs by supporting legislation that would actually kill those jobs. I mean, that's Pennsylvania's future. I, on the other hand, have been, I wasn't in politics my whole life. I didn't even like politics growing up. I was a Democrat growing up, like most people in northeastern Pennsylvania. You needed to be a Democrat or, you know, you just didn't get a job. So our grandparents, that's what they were. And that was passed on. But what happened was, you know, they were JFK Democrats, especially in northeastern Pennsylvania. And as the party kept shifting, a lot of those folks didn't relate any longer to what that party was standing for. However, they wouldn't switch their registration because they're afraid their grandparents would roll over in their grave if they switched to Republican. But they quietly go in the booth and vote however they want to. They vote for the person. And I grew up as a blue-collar person. I worked in a construction company, my family's construction company, and was a mayor only because I didn't like the politics in Hazleton, where mayor and council were fighting all the time, and I always thought government should run as a business. And I had an illegal immigration problem in Hazleton and was left by myself to try to deal with it. Nobody in the country wanted to even go there. For obvious reasons, you're going to be called names, you're going to have to defend yourself, and I didn't have any high-priced consultants to help me. I just stood there in front of the whole country and stood for what I believed in. And I think that's lacking in Washington. I think what we see in Washington are politicians who are more worried about getting reelected than actually taking a stand for something they believe in. And I just believe I represent Pennsylvania better today than Senator Casey does. You know, his values and what he's standing up for, sanctuary cities, open borders, against the tax cuts, against the economy that's helping so many people, against energy. Well, that might be good for the people in California, but I don't think we should give California three senators. I think we should have two here in Pennsylvania that represent our values.
I'm curious. You said that Senator Casey has changed from when he was first elected and that you were a Democrat. Have you voted for Bob Casey in the past?
No, but when he ran in 2006, I supported Rick Santorum. I was actually friends with Senator Santorum at the time, and so I had supported Santorum. You know, and going back to, geez, he's been in office so long. Bob Casey, I think 22 years. I probably did vote for him somewhere along the line, but I just don't remember that. I don't know.
Just don't remember that.
Doesn't relate to this Bob Casey. He's different.
Let's talk about immigration that you brought up, and that is what you became known for when you were mayor of Hazleton. As you said, the federal government at the time was not doing anything about illegal immigration. There's some question about whether they've done anything even since. But that is what you became known for. You talked about the caravan of immigrants from Central America that are making their way to the United States. President Trump has said that he feels that he said that there are terrorists, Middle Eastern terrorists, and that there are others in there, MS-13 gang members that are amongst those groups. Where others are reported, it's mostly women and children. You agree with the president?
Well, I do agree with the president because I serve on the Homeland Security Committee. I serve on the Counterterrorism and Intelligence Subcommittee. I also serve on the Border Security. We know that Middle Easterners are using our southern border to try to get into the United States. There are reports that most of the caravan, what is now turned into a mob-like group, are mostly males. There is no question that MS-13 is coming into the United States through our southern border. You know, we can't turn our head. We need to know who's coming into the country for our own safety and security. We also know that those that come into the country and make a claim of asylum, 80% of them are rejected, not telling the truth. Now, our country can't be this stupid to just say, well, they're all great people, every one of them, and if a couple of MS-13 members happen to get in, as long as they don't hurt anybody in my family, if one or two terrorists happen to be in that middle of that pack, that's okay. It's not. We have an obligation to protect everybody in the United States, and we have a way to come into the country. It's not that we're a country ignorant of other people's wishes. However, American people have wishes, too. We want to be safe. We want to have a legal process of how to come in here. How we've gotten to the point where other people in other countries determine whether or not they could come into the country, and too bad for those of us that want to enforce the laws, it has to stop. We have to have laws, and people have a proper way to come into the country.
You say you're on the Homeland Security Committee. I heard a figure reported from the federal government of 300,000 immigrants from Central America that had come into the United States. Only 800 were of Middle Eastern descent. You don't believe that figure? You don't find that credible?
No. I mean, if I had 10 grapes here and I told you one of the 10 had poison in them, how many grapes would you eat? Probably none. So, you know, to tell the American people, well, there's only so many Middle Easterners who could be involved with terrorists, so, you know, chill out, don't worry about that. That's just not acceptable. That's not acceptable. We have a way for all those folks to come into this country through the legal process. We should know the background of every single one of them. We should not say, well, it's okay, it's only a small percentage. It's not okay. We need to know who's coming into the country. We need to know their background. We need to know their medical history as well. We have children in schools that we want to protect. And so I'm one who believes that we want to welcome immigrants. We want people to come here, but we want them to come through the legal process. So we check their backgrounds. We check who they are. And then allow them to come in.
So that's what your position is when it comes to immigration. I mean, this is a big issue. As I said, I remember talking to you 15 years ago when the federal government.
Nobody believed me then when I said this is immigration, illegal immigration is a problem. I was called, oh, he's a one-trick pony. You know, he's using an issue that's not even important. Nobody cares. Well, we're watching now 12,000 people try to invade our country from the southern border. Is it an issue now? You know, maybe they should have listened to me back in 2006 when I said, listen, people are using fraudulent documents to get into this country where law enforcement has no idea who we're dealing with. Our population in Hazleton grew by 50%, but our tax revenue stayed the same. You try to provide services to people with 50% more people, but not an extra penny. Guess who gets cheated out of services? You know, the people who are paying their taxes paying for people who aren't paying their taxes. You know, this can go on and on and on, how the hospitals are affected, how our schools are affected. I saw what illegal immigration can do to a small community. I saw it firsthand. I wasn't briefed on it by people in Washington. I woke up every day and went to City Hall and had to deal with it when the people were looking at me and saying, you better do something. Well, here we are, 2018, and now we have 12,000 people trying to invade the southern border. Now Yale came out with a study. It's not 11 million people who are here illegally. It's 22 million people who are here illegally. And we still have people in Washington who want to create a pathway to citizenship without securing the border, which is going to bring another 22 million people. It's got to stop. You know, it's got to stop.
Why do you use the word invade?
Because it is. It is. It's literally an invasion, what you're seeing right now, because they're demanding that they're going to come into the United States. That's not the way it works. Other people can't determine if they're going to come or not. The fact that they are said they're just coming and marching right in. What would you call that? It's an invitation? I don't think they got an invitation in the mail. I would say that they're demanding to come into the United States and then stay here. We've got to tell the world this is the greatest country in the world, and we are a country of immigrants, and we want to continue to welcome immigrants, and we want to continue to give immigrants an opportunity for a better life. And welcome. We all came from, you know, all of our ancestors.
So just to clarify, what is your position on immigration then?
Pretty simple. Let's secure the border. Make sure people, and that includes visa overstays. Nearly 50% of the people that come here illegally, they don't cross the border illegally. They come on a visa. Visa expires and we can't find them. And the 9/11 Commission is very clear that that's how many terrorists do get into the country legally on a visa. So we have to make sure we secure the border, stop people from coming into the country illegally, push people into the legal process of coming here, and make our legal immigration system work as well. Many times people wait so long to try to get here legally. We also allow too many people who do not have the skills that we actually need for jobs that are here in the United States. Agriculture is a perfect example where we don't have enough workers. We don't have the right workers for ag labor. And our guest worker program doesn't work for them, so they're forced to use illegal workers, and I get that. Let's fix it so that it works for our agriculture. And we don't push people. You know, when you're bringing in so many folks who may not have skills that we need, you're hurting people at the lower end of the economic ladder because they're competing now for those jobs, and we can't push people out on the street and push them into welfare. You know, we should try to increase wages and bring people who we actually need here.
I want to get on to some other issues because there are a lot of them, but quickly, you support building a wall?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We need to build others. Listen, I've been down to the border a number of times. I saw firsthand, you know, what happens. There are places where, you know, you can use technology.
And that's what many of the opponents of the wall have said, that technology could be used better.
Yeah, there's places where you can use technology that will work and it'll be less costly than building a wall. But where there are populated areas, there is no way that we can stop people from coming in here without a wall, without a structure to physically stop them from coming in.
Let's move on to some other issues. This election may be more about President Trump than maybe any other issue. You probably more than any other candidate in Pennsylvania are closely associated with President Trump. I see you're making some faces, so you disagree with that.
No, I agree. I mean, there's no question. I agree with that.
Okay, all right. Yeah. So do you accept that description that you are closely associated with the president, and why?
Sure. I was one of the first to endorse him in Congress, in the country. I co-chaired his campaign here in Pennsylvania. I was on his transition team as well, and continue to have a good relationship with the administration. So there's no separating that. And I'm not going to do one thing and say something else, to try to get elected. You know, I am. And listen, I'm pretty happy to say that I support the policies that put a lot of people to work, that took a lot of people off of food stamps, you know, that are standing up and become the voice of the forgotten men and women who finally have a voice. Why apologize for that? You know, why are politicians so squishy that they're afraid because some people may not like the personality? How many people don't like the policies? Not too many. Everybody's doing pretty good. The stock market's doing pretty good. 4 million people came off of food stamps. That's great. When 13 million went on food stamps under the Obama administration, under President Trump, 4 million came off. There were more jobs than people were unemployed. Every metric of the economy has people doing better. He's standing up about for our security. He's telling the rest of the world, you're not going to steal our jobs any longer. China and other countries who took our manufacturing jobs are stealing our intellectual property. We finally have a president that is flexing the American muscle and saying, listen, you're not going to take advantage of American workers. Why would I apologize for any of that?
I don't know if anyone's asking you to apologize, but at the same time, you referenced this, that the president's personality is different than probably any other American president. He is a polarizing figure. His supporters love President Trump. Republicans overwhelmingly support the president. But there are detractors out there, and I've heard many descriptions of how they feel about the president. This is more of a political question. Even if all those Republicans that support President Trump support you, you're going to need more than just that to win this election.
Yeah, so what's more important, personality or policies? If we're going to judge by personalities, I've gotten to know a lot of people in Washington. Let me tell you, I wouldn't vote for many of them. And I think we saw that on display during the Kavanaugh hearings, where they were willing to destroy and smear a good man and made him, in America, we're not guilty until you prove yourself innocent. We're all in trouble if that's what we turn to. If this becomes a country that somebody can accuse you of something with no proof and destroy your life and ruin your good reputation that you've worked for your whole life, are we going to allow that? You want to talk about personalities? Just take a good look at those hearings again and you tell me what matters, personalities or policies. It's policies that are going to be good for my children and your children and our grandchildren and America moving forward. When history looks back, nobody's going to feel the personalities of people. They're going to absolutely look at the policies and are people better off today than they were 2 years ago? And that's what matters to me.
But at the same time, are there times where you say to yourself, I wish the president hadn't have said that, or I wish he hadn't tweeted that?
Listen, I'm a big boy. There's times when I said that about what things I said in front of my wife. You know, I wish I didn't say that. I wish I would. I mean, we all do that. I'm not going to judge you by that. I judge you by what you do. That's what matters to me. We're there to make life better for the American people, not to go out and have a dinner party with everyone and say, boy, I really like him, or that's good, but that doesn't pay your bills. What matters, you know, whether or not your job is going to be there today, tomorrow, in the future, whether or not you can send your children to college, whether or not we're going to be safe as a country. I remember, and we're probably, I might be older than you, I'm sure, but I remember going to bed every night and asking my mother, is Russia going to bomb us? I was so afraid. You know, we used to have drills where we put our heads under our desk, you know, where do we want our children? That's what matters to me. It's not this other stuff. It's entertainment. It's all entertainment. People like it. People hate it. And nothing's going to change. Nothing's going to change. That's going to be the way it is. You can like or not like somebody's personality. And I agree, and I don't diminish that. I don't say there are people who really are annoyed by that stuff. But for someone like myself, I'm worried about getting this country straightened out. I didn't want another politician. That's why I was one of the first in the country to endorse him. I'm sick of politicians lying to the American people, smooth-talking, you know, tell you what you want to hear, get themselves reelected, and then leave the American people down. I'm tired of that. So I'm willing to trade some roughness, some brashness, some things that, you know, nobody really likes to get this country back to work again and do the things that we're seeing happen.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. We're joined today by Lou Barletta, the Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate, the November 6th election coming up in less than 2 weeks. He's running against U.S. Senator Bob Casey. Let's talk about some other issues. Tax relief. You mentioned that. You referenced the tax cuts a little bit earlier. This is one of those issues, and there certainly are a lot of them across this country, but a lot of people will disagree whether this has had a positive impact or not. You know, there have been studies from the Congressional Budget Office that said that the top 1% of income earners are those who have benefited the most. Corporations that maybe at first gave some bonuses away to some of their workers, but at the same time, they went back and bought stock in their own company. That middle-class Americans, for the most part, have not benefited that much. What do you say to
that? Not true. Not true. You know, child tax credit gone from $1,000 doubled to $2,000. The standard deduction, which 70% of the American people take, went from $12,000 to $24,000 for a married couple. Your first $24,000 tax-free, zero. The average family earning $40,000, the family of four earning $40,000, will see a $1,447 rebate. Do you know the amount of people that cannot even afford a $400 emergency? It was like 40%, 44% of the American people, if they had an emergency today that was $400, couldn't afford it. Maybe Nancy Pelosi thinks that's crumbs because she's a lot richer than most of us, but they're not crumbs to the people who are valuing $20, $40, $50. PPL just reduced their rates, gave a rebate because of the tax cuts. Maybe that might not mean a lot to somebody that has a lot of money, but somebody who's working paycheck to paycheck, that matters to them. 6 million people got either a bonus or a wage increase because of the tax cuts. And anybody that understands business understands that by lowering our corporate rates, we are now bringing businesses back from other countries into the United States because now we're competitive again. And who's that good for? That's good for people who are working there because we're going to see wages increase now because there's a competition for wages because we have now more jobs than people who are unemployed. So that's a good thing because businesses are going to pay you more money because they don't want you to go across the street and work for somebody else. This is all economics 101. What do people think the economy is soaring from? From what? I mean, for those that believe the description that you said, we saw growth at 2% under people who believe that. Let's tell everyone, we want jobs, but we don't want the employer to succeed. That's like saying I like eggs, but I want to kill the chicken. You don't get the eggs without the chicken. You don't get the jobs without the businesses. It's pretty clear. And how do they think? I know President Obama said, well, what's he going to do, wave a magic wand? Well, abracadabra, how is this happening? How is the economy soaring? What do you think it's from? If people don't like President Trump, then why is the economy doing so well? It's the policies of lowering taxes, let business invest, back off some regulations, and we're watching what's happening right before our eyes.
You know, one of the things that I find fascinating is that for every statement, we can find another statement. And I'm not here to argue those facts, but there would be people who would say that that tax cut was enacted in December and that this recovery began even before President Trump came into office.
I challenge because I hear that all the time. And in fact, President Obama tries to convince people that he's trying to rewrite history and rewrite the facts. So tell me one policy that he has that would have caused this. I would like to hear him say, tell me one policy that he had that would have caused this.
Well, there is the figures have shown that I saw one just last week that President Obama and the jobs created were comparable between the Trump administration and the last 2 years of the Obama administration.
Well, there's more people working now than ever before. I mean, every metric of the economy is getting better and better and better than ever before. So, listen, we're doing good for the people. Let's keep it going.
We only have a few minutes left, but one thing I do have to bring up with that is, and as I said, we always there's a but when we have these conversations, is the budget deficit, estimated to be about $1 trillion next year. Republicans traditionally over the years, that has been a major issue for Republicans in office and those running for office. What do we do about that?
So just remember, especially the Democrats who are now saying, oh my gosh, the debt. What are you doing? Look what they're increasing the debt by the tax cuts. This is the same party that saw the largest increase in our debt in the history of our country. We went from $10 trillion to over $20 trillion. The debt increased more under President Obama than every president going back to George Washington. All of a sudden, the Democrats woke up. Oh, my gosh, we got to do something about the debt. That's pretty hypocritical. But here's the thing. We need to grow the economy. That's how you reduce the debt. You grow the economy. We need more revenue. If you were a business, you know, it would be clear to you, listen, we've got to watch our spending. But to get out of the hole is we need more customers. We need more customers. More customers, more money, more revenue. And that's how we begin to decrease our debt. We grow the economy. We're growing at 4.2% right now. That helps Social Security. That helps Medicare because you have more workers. When you have more workers, they're paying more taxes. When you have more taxes, you have more revenue. So we have to grow the economy. We have to attack the things in Washington that add to our debt, interest on our debt. We've got to stop that. And anybody has a credit card, it's hard paying a minimum payment to ever get that balance down because it seems like, geez, that interest is more than what I'm paying. And it's the same way with us. We just need sound business ideas, grow the economy, let's cut our spending, let's attack the cost of government to where we can have some control over it, and we'll watch that debt come down.
Congressman Barletta, we're almost out of time, and I always like to have our candidates leave a message with voters. What would that be?
Well, the message is, you know, Bob Casey's represented us for 12 years. I believe in term limits to begin with. I think people get in Washington and they lose their way. And I think that's what's happened here with Senator Casey. I think he's gone to Washington, forgot about us. I've traveled the state. People say we don't see him. I don't know what he's done in 12 years. And he's now taken a position that really represents people more in California than people here in Pennsylvania. We don't want sanctuary cities. We don't want open borders. We don't want the government to take more taxes. I stand on the other side of that. I've been somebody who understands that if you have more of your money and if you're safe and your family's safe and your future's better, we're seeing the greatest economy that we've seen, at least in our lifetime. I want to continue that. I don't want to do anything to get in the way. I don't want impeachment hearings. I don't want this crazy mob mentality that's happening in Washington right now. I think Senator Casey has run a disgraceful campaign against me, scaring senior citizens with facts that aren't true, scaring people who are sick, the most vulnerable, people who have illnesses, willing to scare them to get elected, and attacking me on an issue that I think was not only insensitive but was heartless. I don't think you deserve a vote when you're willing to do that, to get reelected again. So, I'm going to give people an alternative, a change, somebody who's going to stand up for them and isn't afraid to say what I really think and have somebody who's honest.
I do have to follow up on that. What you're referencing is a campaign commercial that Senator Casey ran about. It was a family from Mannheim with two daughters who had cancer. And you unfortunately have a grandson that...
It's twins. It was twins. I told Senator Casey the story. It was a personal story about twins, grandchildren that we have. And the little boy, Jordan, 18 months old, was diagnosed with cancer, very serious cancer. I confided in telling Senator Casey this story of how disturbed I was and upset we were just learning this. Jordan needs 42 weeks of chemotherapy and radiation. And a month later, from the time I told him about the twins and the cancer, my brother, who I'm very close with, passes away, which Senator Casey also knew. We buried my brother on a Friday. Saturday, Senator Casey began running commercials mirroring the situation that I told him, twins with cancer. And the woman in the commercial said that if Lou Barletta had his way, children like mine would be denied health care, as if I would deny my own grandson treatment. My family, my daughter, and the rest of my family were so upset. We pleaded with Senator Casey to please take that ad down. It's so sensitive. This is a real situation of an 18-month-old with cancer. His response to me was, votes have consequences, and you'll be held accountable in November. It wasn't, I'm sorry. It wasn't, I didn't realize. It was, I'm going to step on you even more. not even having a decency that we just buried my brother. And I think that ad not only crossed the line, I think it was evil to hurt people who were hurting so bad to try to win an election. He didn't need to run that commercial. There was no purpose for that commercial. He's running two other pre-existing commercials, which aren't true. But at what point do you say, that's way too far? This is a real case. This is a little boy, 18 months old, who has cancer and whose family is scared. And for my daughter to have to see that commercial while she's in a waiting room in Children's Hospital in Philadelphia is disgraceful. He ought to be ashamed of himself. And I think the people of Pennsylvania deserve much better than that.
I do have to follow up on that, though, because it is such a big issue. First of all, sorry for your family's loss, and you know, I'm sure everyone listening to this would hope that Jordan does recover.
That's what I ask.
But as far as healthcare goes, you do support repeal and replace of Obamacare, correct?
And have been openly and actually co-sponsored a bill that said that I would not support anything that did not cover people with pre-existing conditions. Period. I'm on a bill. I can't do any more than that. I'm on a bill that said I would not support anything that did not cover people with pre-existing conditions. And to run ads to scare sick people and to try to twist and take half of a story and use that half of a story because he has all this money to scare sick people to voting for him because they're afraid that what I'm going to do and actually insinuate that I would not even help my 18-month-old grandson is disgraceful. I think we've gone to a new low in American politics, and it's right here in Pennsylvania. And you shouldn't be rewarded with voting and sending a person back who's willing to do something so disgraceful.
Congressman Bartoletta, I hate to end it on that note, but we did discuss a lot of issues. Thank you very much
for
being
Thanks
with us.
Thanks for having me.
WITF's election coverage is supported by the law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein, and Lair. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on Monday Smart Talk, Republican Congressman Scott Perry, who's running for re-election, and Republican candidate for Congress, Dan Mueser. Welcome back to Smart Talk. In 1818, Mary Shelley wrote what may be the definitive Halloween story, Frankenstein, about a mad scientist who brings a creature to life. With Halloween next week, the National Endowment for the Humanities is launching Frankenreads, events celebrating the novel's bicentennial. Events culminate Wednesday, Halloween, in a series of full-length live readings. Joining us today is Professor Ashton Nichols, Professor of Language and Literature in the Department of English at Dickinson College. Professor Nichols, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Scott.
All right, I just got to get everyone in the mood before we start our discussion.
Please do.
That's from 1931 and one of many, many movie adaptations that involve Frankenstein. But just to hear that, now that's a movie adaptation, and we're going to be talking about the novel that was the inspiration for all those movies. But what is it about Frankenstein that all these years later, 200 years, as I call it, the ultimate Halloween story?
As I say to my students, Scott, it's really quite remarkable that a young woman of 18 years old wrote this novel that has lasted as long as now its own bicentennial. She actually began the novel in 1816 and found her publisher, like all writers, often have to wait 2 years later. But the story captures so many important themes and ideas that go beyond the creation of life that I think many people are surprised when they first begin to read the novel, and I certainly recommend that all of your listeners get a copy before Halloween, and they grow continually more surprised as they go further into the story and deepen their own understanding of how many issues Mary Shelley is trying to address.
Well, like what?
Well, like many of the misconceptions about the novel, I heard you say appropriately to your film clip that Frankenstein, by the way, is not the monster.
Nope.
The monster has no name. He's called at various points in the story the wretch, the creature, the thing, and Mary Shelley herself referred to him in the second edition of the story as her own hideous progeny. She also had children as the wife of Percy Shelley, the romantic poet. But in fact, Frankenstein, who makes the monster, is not a mad scientist at all. He says that his goal is to end death. His own mother dies of scarlet fever while he's at university, and he suddenly begins to think, what if I could uncover the secret of life and thereby prevent the deaths of all of our loved ones? He says, in fact, to quote him, I wanted to pour a torrent of light onto a dark world. That's not a very crazy idea. When the story begins to go wrong is when Victor Frankenstein, who, by the way, is also not a doctor, it's a mistake to call him Dr. Frankenstein. He's a medical student. He's studying at a university in Switzerland at the time. And he finishes his monster on what Mary calls a dreary night of November. So the films certainly have the lightning and the thunder and the darkness right. He looks down at the thing he's made and he says, great God, beautiful. And he literally runs out of the room. The monster is almost 8 feet tall. He's not stitched together very well. And his own creator literally is so disgusted looking at the physical appearance of the thing he's made that he abandons it entirely. The monster has no mother, of course. And now his father, as it were, his creator, has abandoned him. In fact, it's true that many modern psychologists continue to read the novel as a story about parental abandonment. What happens to children or our creations if we don't accept responsibility for having made them? So there's one of the first themes that is unexpected for the greatest monster story.
By the way, if you'd like to join us in this conversation, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So how did all these myths about Frankenstein, and just going to refer to the story as Frankenstein, How did all these myths develop over the years?
Hollywood is really the main culprit. If we looked, and I don't mean culprit necessarily in a negative sense, I teach the films as part of my own classes because they are so important to the history of what is rightly called, I've often said, one of the few truly modern myths. She has created something that has enough richness in it that I predict it will last certainly as long as Pandora's Box or the story of the Titans living on Mount Olympus. The misconceptions arise because most people's first image of Frankenstein either comes from a Halloween costume that will still fill the streets next Wednesday night around the world, in fact, not just the United States. And the second introduction, as you noted correctly, is usually the 1931 film, directed by an Englishman called James Whale, who knew the original story well, having been brought up in Britain. But Whale was very insistent that he get Boris Karloff as his monster. He gave him 6-inch boots. He gave him a 4-inch flat top on the top of his head, and he stuck the 2 electrical bolts in his neck. And so whenever people see their first early images of Frankenstein, they usually see, in large type, Frankenstein, and then they see Boris Karloff. So it's understandable that they would associate the name with the thing. On the other hand, Mary, for example, in the novel, doesn't ever tell us how Victor Frankenstein did this. When people flocked to inquire, tell us, please, how did he make life? Mary would either say, I don't know, or she would say, it was essential that I keep those important facts a secret. So we never even know that the secret was electricity, although certainly that's come to be the general association. Our local friend Ben Franklin had only flown his kite in a lightning storm fairly recently. Electricity was literally in its completely experimental stages in the 18-teens and 1820s. No one had electric lights. And so electricity in some ways was still this very mysterious force that has come to be associated with what was going on in Victor's laboratory. And certainly by the time Weyl put Karloff on that famous, you know, platform covered in a sheet, it was clear that what was going on around this monster had mostly to do with electric sparks and flashing lights.
Hence the thunderstorm.
Bingo. Mm.
All right, so let's go back to Mary Shelley, as you mentioned.
Please.
A lot of people may not know this, that she was the wife of Percy Bysshe Shelley. But Mary Shelley, the novel was written, as you said, in 1816 as a challenge.
Exactly.
How?
Exactly. Their friend Lord Byron was the richest member of their circle. Lord Byron rented a beautiful home, what we would call a stately country manor, on the shores of Lake Geneva, and they were going to spend the summer there, discussing philosophy, as they loved to do, having dinner parties that we would have loved to be a guest at in terms of the conversation that was flowing back and forth. They had planned their summer for sailing on the lake, hiking in the Swiss Alps. And this is an interesting side note that has come to get a lot of attention in modern times. The largest volcanic eruption in human history took place on an island called Tambora in the South Seas. The volcano threw enough pumice and ash into the atmosphere that it circled the world something like three or four times, and it literally blocked out the sun. 1816 came to be known as the year without a summer. There was snow in Paris in July, and this group of romantic writers and thinkers was literally cooped up in Byron's house. It rained constantly, there was sleet, it was cold outside, and they had nowhere to go. Byron one night said, they'd been reading German ghost stories, Byron said, let's each write a ghost story, and let's have a contest to see who can write the best of those stories. I think we all know who won the contest. Byron produced a miserable, unfinished poem about a woman who had a skull where her head belonged. But very interestingly, Byron, like a lot of wealthy lords, as he was a hereditary lord at the time, he traveled with his own personal physician. That young man was named John Polidori, and he was an Italian emigre to Britain. Polidori had traveled widely in Romania near the time that they were all stuck in Geneva, outside of Geneva. Polidori, for his submission to the ghost story contest, wrote a 12 to 14 page short story, we would call it. But it was called The Vampyr, V-A-M-P-Y-R. It was the first written vampire story in the English language. When Bram Stoker, almost a century later, had the idea to write another novel we may know called Dracula, and certainly another film we'll know, it was Polidori's original vampire story that inspired Bram Stoker.
That was quite a night.
That was a busy night.
I would think. I mean, they're probably the two most classic horror or scary stories of all time, and they both developed at the same time.
Brought together under virtually identical circumstances. In fact, Mary said that when Byron posed the challenge, as I mentioned, she was 18 years old.
Which is amazing.
She was trying to fall asleep, she said, and of course she couldn't. because these ideas from the ghost stories they had been reading were percolating in her mind. She said she tossed and turned. And just as she was in that strange state we all know, where you're half asleep and half awake and you're not sure if you're dreaming or experiencing reality, Mary says, "I saw the pale student of the unhallowed arts bending over the body of the thing he had made." And that literally, we know, unlike many great novels, we know the first image and we know the moment of, let's call it, conception, at which point the Frankenstein story truly came into being.
You know, that 1931 version is still the scariest.
I couldn't agree more. I encourage everybody to find a viewing of Boris Karloff as the monster in 1931 and turn out all the lights in the room and get ready to be truly frightened. It's quite remarkable. In fact, Whale was also the director of The Famous Bride of Frankenstein only 4 years later, in which Elsa Lancaster has the wonderful black and white hairdo that flares back from her head 3 or 4 feet. And when Frankenstein in the novel has asked his creator for a mate, he says, "If you give me a mate, I'll go away. I'll leave humanity alone. Just make sure that you make her look somewhat like I do." And in the novel, Victor Frankenstein never does this. He starts to make the mate, but I'll leave it to readers to find out what happens in the original. In the film, the bride comes to life. She's trying to get her bearings, as any newly born adult would be, and she looks first at Victor Frankenstein, the creator, who's a rather handsome-looking young Englishman. He was in his early 20s in the novel. And then she looks to the monster. And then she turns back and she moves toward Victor Frankenstein as though he's the one that she wants to be in love with. And this creates all sorts of terror and ruination in The Bride of Frankenstein.
We only have about 2 minutes left, and this is so fascinating. But Frankenreads, it's an international event that's coming up on next Wednesday. First of all, explain what that is. Dickinson is one of many Pennsylvania colleges that is participating.
We are indeed. There are over 500 libraries, colleges, and universities around the world now, Asia, Europe, South America, Africa. All of these universities, libraries, and colleges are putting on events. They're staging plays because there were plays of Frankenstein from 5 years after its publication on the stage in London, throughout Europe. They're having readings. Dickinson will be having a reading of selections from the novel, not the entire novel, from 3 to 4 o'clock next Wednesday afternoon in our Wadner Spahr Library, open to the public. And we will also be opening an exhibit that my students have put on in our library that will display not only materials from 1818 and surrounding era that helped to produce the story. The second case will include the influences that Frankenstein has had. So everyone is having their own event. Everyone is designing their own activities. The Library of Congress, in fact, we'll be reading the entire novel over, I believe, 2 days, which is probably what it takes to read it out loud.
Professor Ashton Nichols, Professor of Language and Literature in the Department of English at Dickinson College. I'm curious, I only have about 20 seconds left, but what are you going to do next Wednesday other than being involved in an event? How do you celebrate Halloween?
My students keep inquiring. I've told them they get extra credit if they come in costume. And I won't be saying a word about whether I'll be in costume or not.
Professor, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
Coming up on Monday, we continue our conversations with candidates, Congressman Scott Perry and Republican candidate for Congress Dan Mueser, coming up on Monday.